Now I'm all pinned in here.
Have to get the prayer book. Somebody needs to help me with the prayers here today. Donna, come on, help me. This, what are we going to do first, second, and third? I need an omse. Whatever she said, we'll do. All right, what was first? All right, so that's Taya. Anybody who's new, real new, that first time ever? Bless your heart. All right, there's three. Okay, so this is a mantra, Shakyamuni Buddha's mantra. If you could take all of his teachings, he taught for like 40 years, and distill them. It's like a reduction. If you're a cook, you know, you reduce it down to this mantra. Everything, this mantra symbolizes everything the Buddha ever taught. Bam. And so you need to think the very powerful words. We're going to say it seven times. Is that right, Donna? Seven times. Okay. So we're gonna. It's the song. It's sung too. It's like Taya Ta, Om Mane Mane, Maha Mane Soa, Taya Ta, Om Mane Mane, Maha Mane Soa. Taya ta om mane mane maha maniye 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 soa. All right, and the four measurables. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. And may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Now do that in Tibetan. All right, I'm not good at that, so who, okay. Chen tan che de wa dang de wei gu dang dem ba gyu ji du. La ne pas. 8, O Monies, first, O Money Pim. So that one's, again, this is the mantra for the new people. This is the mantra of the Buddha of Compassion. And there are lots of tunes to it. But again, it's O Money Pim Hum, and we'll sing it to a tune. But it's it focuses the mind, but it also has a certain vibration to it. You can think of it as sort of activating the energy of compassion in your own mind. And the visual representation of Chinrezig is right there. Thousand arm Chinrezig. Could be forearm, but that's thousand arm. And then the green Tara, Om Tare Tu Tare Turi Soha, is this green, beautiful green lady who symbolizes the perfection of compassionate action, just like the green is an action color. So we'll do I have my own tune for Om Mani Padme Hum, so let me hear the one that we do. Mani Padme Hum, like that. Oh Mani Padme Hum, Om 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 Mani Padme Hum. That was more than seven. That's okay. Now, again, help me here with the tune. Om Tari Tu Tari Tu Re Soha. Om Tari Tu Tari Tu Re Soha. Om Tari Tu Tari Tu Re Soha. Tari Tu Tari Tu Re Soha. Om Tari Tu Tari Tu Re Soha. Om Tari Tu Tari Tu Re Soha. Om Tari Tu Tari Tu Re Soha. So my name's just some people don't know who I am. Last time I did this, at the end of the talk, somebody said, "Who was that guy?" So I guess I should say who. So I'm Don Brown. I'm one of the old timers around here, and I teach Discovering Buddhism, and sometimes on Sundays I talk, and. Sarah Brooks said she's going to keep her eye on me, make sure I'm not giving out any false information. She'll get me. So anyway, I'll do my best to represent Tibetan Buddhist tradition. I've been, not that this means anything, but I've been studying Buddhism for about 35 years, something like that. So that's one of the reasons I wanted to talk about what I wrote up there today. But we're going to start out by doing some practices, just kind of get the mind ready for the teachings. So I'm making this up as I go, so let me think about it. So I think we'll start out with just mindfulness of the breath. Now, this is a real simple thing to do, because we breathe all the time. You want to sit up straight. If you're in a chair, you know, you don't want to be, you can sit back if you want to, but the idea is you want your vertebrae to be sitting one on top of the other like checkers, you know, and that kind of keeps you more alert. Your hands can be sitting in your lap in a more traditional way like that, or you can just hold your palms in your lap like that. And bring your awareness to your breath. And you can silently count. Geshe-la teaches this. I think it's pretty good. you can silently count to 21. And once you get to 21, you come. If you lose count at 1 or 2 or 3, you have to come back. But, you know, if you get up to 21, that's great. You can start over again. Most people will find that they're lucky to get to 5 before they get lost. But you breathe out and in as one. So silently. You're not going like that. You don't want the people next to you distracted by your breathing. So just kind of following the breath very naturally and gently. You breathe out and in one. Out and in two, up to 21. So we do this, and this is kind of cool, but because your mind will try to take off, and because this is boring, to be honest with you, it is. And so your mind wants something exciting, and so drawn to some object of attachment or something more interesting. As soon as you catch yourself being distracted, bring your mind right back to the breath. That's the practice. That's the crucial part of it. Bringing your mind back. Even if you just do it one time in the next 5 minutes, then you've meditated. If all you do is daydream, you haven't meditated. You find your mind wandering off and you have to bring it back again and again. It doesn't mean that you're a bad person or that you're a loser. This is the practice. This is the practice of training your mind. We have not been taught to do this. So this is a new thing for a lot of us, to really discipline the mind and keep it focused on one object. Now we're going to shift from this one kind of meditation, which is the focusing kind of concentration practice that we were just doing, to a different kind of practice. And this is contemplative type meditation. We're just going to review some of the points that the key point in all of Mahayana Buddhism, which is what's taught at the center, is one of the key points, but the main thing that distinguishes Mahayana Buddhism from other versions of it, such as Zen, that would be practiced in China and Japan, or in some certain parts of like Vietnam, and Theravada, which is practiced in Burma and Thailand and Laos and Sri Lanka and certain parts of South India. So Tibetan Buddhism, Mahayana Buddhism, is actually Zen shares the same motivation. But it's the motivation is that we're practicing to develop ourselves, not just for our own benefit, but principally is to develop our good qualities and eliminate our faults, our harmful mental states and the actions of body and mind that follow this harmful mental state. We want to eliminate those and develop all of our good qualities, compassion, wisdom, and so forth. To fully develop those qualities. We want to do that not just for our own well-being, but so that principally we want to do it so we can help others. That's the goal. So that's the intention. This is called the awakening mind, bodhicitta, the mind of enlightenment. Lots of different ways to describe it, but it's what it boils down to is two things. I want to help others to achieve their full potential and find true, lasting, not only happiness, but bliss and joy and freedom. Okay? Not temporary happiness, but something that's way more profound than that. And the method to do that is that I have to get my act together. I have to develop my own good qualities and eliminate my faults to truly be able to accomplish what I want to do. So the work starts right here with this one. With me, with you. So one way to to briefly think about this is to think, contemplate, well, you know, everybody's the same in one really important way. We all want happiness, and none of us want to suffer. And we instinctively think that my happiness is more important than her happiness or his happiness. That's just how we operate. As they say, that's how we roll. I'm the most important one, and in the sentence, that's just how we operate. But in fact, everybody equally wants happiness and equally doesn't want to suffer. Every living being, even animals, insects, all want the same thing. They want to live, they want to be happy, they want to have a full stomach, and they do not want to suffer. So, I'm just one. And we think, well, others, that's, we think of others as one too, but others are actually infinite. Countless beings are others. So whose happiness is more important, the happiness of one or the happiness of countless others? We all equally want it. Whose happiness is most important? Well, our ego, which is our biggest problem, our self-centered ego, says, well, I'm the most important. My happiness is most important. But in fact, if you really think about it, the happiness of others is way more important than the happiness of just one person, if you're looking at it objectively. But at least others' happiness is equal to my happiness in terms of desire for happiness and desire to avoid suffering. If we can get to that point mentally, that's huge. We all equally want happiness and avoid suffering. Everybody in this room, exactly the same. We've got lots of stories we make up about our lives and who we are and who we aren't. But next time you look in somebody's eyes, you go, wow, whatever's coming out of their mouth, there are two things that are driving them. I want happiness. I don't want to suffer. That's it. In a nutshell. Buddhism, we say the cause of all suffering is self-cherishing selfishness. Self-cherishing selfishness. Think about it. Killing, stealing, adultery, lying, slander, harsh speech, idle gossip, hatred, fear, jealousy, pride, anger, ignorance, 84,000 delusions, in fact. All of them derive from one demon. There's one demon in one devil, and it resides right in the center of our mind. It's called ignorance, which is self-cherishing selfishness. Thinking, I'm the most important one. I'm the center of the universe. The world is here to please me. If it's delicious, I want it. If it's not delicious, get it away from me. Me, 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 I. Source of all pain and suffering. From the beginning of beginningless time until now, that's the one demon. any action motivated by that mind will always, always, always lead to pain. Eventually. Might give you some temporary pleasure now. Long term, big problems. Big problems. And the cause of happiness is cherishing others. The cause of any action motivated by this, the energy of self-cherishing is like, it's kind of dark and gloomy and tight and uptight and constricted and so forth. The energy of cherishing others is sort of, you can feel the energy is more, is focused outward. It's completely opposite of self-cherishing, cherishing others. And if you cherish others, you wouldn't kill them. You wouldn't steal from them. You wouldn't, commit adultery. You know, to harm your family and blah, blah, blah. And lying to others, stealing and bad-mouthing people and wasting their time with idle gossip and so on. Cherishing others is the source of all happiness. Bumper sticker, Lama's, that somebody put, that's quoting Lama's up, very simple. For happiness, cherish others. For happiness, cherish others. Easy. So easy. And so hard to do. And then the next step is to exchange this is a little mental aikido. Or, Aikido, but anyway, it's like where you just kind of switch self-cherishing mind. You imagine, this is a little practice that we do, we imagine that on this body and mind, this collection of body and mind, so-called five aggregates, four mental and one physical. So it's just the body and mind. On this body and mind, now instead of labeling it I, you label it others. And on the ones out there, we label those I. Okay? So now, when you get up in the morning, you get up for who? Others, because now my name is others. You get dressed and try to look your best for others. You work hard for others. You know, you take care of your health so you can serve others. You practice focusing outward on others. This is called exchanging self-cherishing for cherishing others. This is the title of this little contemplation. A very profound practice. And then in developing this awakening mind, we get, you know, one of the bodhisattvas, these awakening warriors, these practitioners who've done this work for so many years and have really transformed their mind to the point where, you know, they think this way instinctively, but the contemplation that we do to get there is we think, okay, I am personally responsible for the happiness of all sentient beings throughout all space and time. This attitude sounds so crazy, but it's an attitude that the bodhisattva has. It's not Geshe Gelug's responsibility. It's not Robbie Watkins or Lama Zopa or the Dalai Lama. It's my responsibility. It's, you know, for you. You say it's my responsibility to awaken and then lead all sentient beings from their present state of confusion all the way to the state of full enlightenment. I am personally responsible. And that includes your worst enemies. Ouch. People you don't like. The people that when you as soon as you see them, you turn around and walk away. Even those people you need to get included in this. And then the next contemplation is called generating bodhicitta. And it's based on this kind of thinking. I can't even stop my own suffering. I mean, I'm still a mess. My mind's wild. I can't even count my breath past five without getting lost. You know, I think of myself all the time. You know, I've done all the 10 non-virtuous actions many times, if not in this life, in past lives, and on, we think, gosh, we're so far from enlightenment, it's just ridiculous. I can't even think about it. But we need to think about it. We need to think that I can do it. I can do it. We make this commitment, not just for us. This isn't for us, by the way. This isn't for us. Our happiness is the byproduct of our dedicating our lives to others. Just happens by the way. So we set our goal. I must liberate all sentient beings from suffering and guide them to the highest happiness of enlightenment. And to do that, I'm going to get myself together. I'm going to practice this path that the Buddha has laid out called the Lamrim, you know, which has been laid out so perfectly and has been trod. This path has been practiced by thousands of beings who have achieved enlightenment and achieved extraordinary states of peace and satisfaction and happiness, and I'm going to practice that path. I must become enlightened in order to liberate and to serve all sentient beings. That becomes the instinct for your life. That becomes the driving force for your life. I must practice ethics. I must practice concentration. I must develop wisdom. You know, I must practice the three scopes, three principal aspects of the path, renunciation, bodhicitta, and emptiness. So many ways it's packaged, right? Then there's generation and completion stage of Tantra. But the path's been laid out by our teachers and their teachers before them in an unbroken lineage all the way back to the Buddha. This is not something that's just been concocted and, you know, in the last 15 years. This has been practiced for thousands of years and it works. Nothing wrong with the path. Path's fine. And it's up to us to practice it. I can almost promise you that what we're doing this morning has never been done at the center, but I haven't been here every Sunday, but I don't think we've ever had this kind of conversation before. By the way, I want to take one thing off the table here. Things I don't like about Buddhism. You cannot talk about our center director. He's right here. Well, I'm just teasing. I don't like Robbie Watkins. No, you can't say that. But anyway, I thought about other ways to say this. Don't like seems a little bit too simple. So other words I thought of would be like off-putting. Things that are off-putting about Tibetan Buddhism. Confusing. What's another word? Bewildering. Confusing. Off-putting. Doesn't make sense. It doesn't. Yeah, I have a plant here, by the way. Robbie's going to help me with this. Doesn't make sense. Difficult. Whoops. I don't spell that well. But anyway, you get the point, right? It's like, okay. Well, you know, one of the things that I found very reassuring when I started to study Buddhism, I took comparative religion in college. I thought Buddhism was ridiculous. I had no interest in it at all. It wasn't until I went to Nepal and actually saw these people that were practicing it and were amazing human beings. I went, wow, this is not just a bunch of words and books. This is actually a living spiritual tradition. So anyway, things I don't like about Buddhism. So it's important, I think, the Buddha said, test my teachings, which I really found liberating to hear that. He said, test them like somebody who's assaying gold. You know, just don't believe it because it sounds good or whatever, but check it out. Make sure if it makes sense. If it makes sense to you, if it fits your experience, if it doesn't harm you, if it doesn't harm others, why wouldn't you? Like want to incorporate it into your worldview and into what you're doing. So there's a, you know, most religions wouldn't be having, most spiritual traditions wouldn't be having this conversation about, well, what do you like and what do you don't like? But we can talk about it because you don't have to, in Buddhism, it's not like you go to a banquet and you have to eat everything on the table. You eat what you pick and choose what works for you, and then gradually over time, hopefully we find more and more that's useful. Okay, so don't make me do this, Bummer. Who's a good writer? I can tell you are. Someone let you write. What's your name?
Meg.
Okay, Meg. Thank you. If you can just make a list down here, probably fill up the whole board, but at least if we can come up with one or two. So let's have... Think about this, really, we'll talk on some of these. We may not get to all of them, but we can touch on some of them. Because I've had a lot of problems with Buddhism over the years, so I'll say something too. I'll say one thing. I don't like the kind of foreignness of it. You know, it's not part of this culture. I was raised Presbyterian. You know, I'm like a... can't even think of the guy's name, Martin Luther. I don't know. Is that right? Who was he?
Calvin,
yeah. See, I didn't learn much. I know one thing. Total deprivation, that's one of the main teachings, in which means that you're basically screwed. I remember that part. Anyway, so go ahead. Anybody? You have to speak, or I'm going to start pointing at people. Yes?
I'm confused about, and maybe because I'm just learning.
Uh-huh.
I haven't been learning this all that long. About that the karma ripening from a previous action, maybe from another life,
mm-hmm.
caused somebody to punch me in the face.
Okay. So put down... karma, karmic retribution.
Yeah.
In the front row. I'm pointing now. It could be anything. Don't want to, just we can put. So the depth of love is, you know. Yeah. Yeah, love and attachment. That's a good one. All right. Robbie? Boring. Good. All right. Donna?
Sometimes, having grown up in a Western faith where the promise is if you do good, it's all over and you go to heaven, you know, I miss the concept that this is the only crappy life I have to have. Yeah.
Uh-huh. So you reincarnation, how do we say that? Only, yeah, okay, whatever she said. One crappy life. Well, good point. I tell you what, my dad, he came to one of my classes. I taught, you know, back in the 80s, I was teaching basically discovering Buddhism, but it was in Greenville, North Carolina, where I'm from, and I was teaching this class at Pitt Tech. I'd figured out how to teach a class there, so my dad showed up. He didn't show up for a couple of classes, but he said he didn't like the idea of coming back and again, it's kind of like what you're talking about. He just wanted to be done with it. Yeah, it, again and again to liberate all beings. You know, that didn't appeal to him. He just wanted to be. This life was tough enough. Let's get over with it and go to heaven. It's appealing, huh? Yeah. Yeah, and say, I believe in Jesus Christ, my Lord and Savior. You're going straight up to heaven. Boy, that's attractive. That's a great, you know, we have our own marketing strategy. 3 years, 3 days, and, no, yeah, 3 years, 3 months, and 3 days, you can get enlightened in High Sugar Tantra if you practice completion stage. Yeah, that's good. But getting enlightened in 1 second by just saying something is much more appealing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like I'm never doing enough because it's in every moment you're creating karma, and
it's every single moment, like, I should be practicing, I should be on the path, I should be this, I should be that. It makes me feel sometimes really overwhelmed to know that every single second is just, you know, a billion thoughts.
So not enough, can't do enough, and you're shooting all over yourself. Complex path, isn't it? It's very, you know, there's a lot of it that, I don't want to stop yet. So, let's get, go ahead. Oh, she's got more.
It can be really heavy. I feel like...
What now?
My head, like, if there's so much, like, analysis and this, and I forget to, Qigong and Taoism for that reason, because I, smile at my organs, and I remember to come back to, something simple where I'm, you know, not trying to transcend, I guess.
Right. Okay. All right. Okay.
I feel that way already.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. Okay. So don't. The bug zooka, that's the answer. But, not killing any living being, killing, even insects, that's a hard one. Rodents, rats, mice. Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
So I've been coming here for about 2 years, and I still look around here, and I'm like, what is all of this?
Good.
And so it's like all the symbolism and that sort of thing. So, so it's like, it would be really nice to have like a Gompa tour. Like, this is the medicine Buddha, and this is what he does, and this is Green Tara, and this is what he does, and this is Kali Chakra, and this is what he does. Like,
right.
I look up here, I'm like, well, what is the symbolism of the 21 Buddhas or the 21 Tara?
Right. Well, that was what I kind of meant by the foreignness of it. Because the first time... Anyway, I'm not going to get into my experience. Kathy, what do you say? Oh, wait a minute.
Oh, well, of course.
She might start singing.
So, we talk about we're so preoccupied with the deliciousness of things.
Right.
And, okay, if it's not delicious... I mean, if it doesn't smell good, feel good, taste good, why would I even pick it up? So I'm confused about, and I think you and I have discussed this before, how do we enjoy ourselves if we're following the practice?
And Buddhism has taken away everything.
It's no fun.
There's no more, no fun.
But yet I see monks, nuns laughing their heads off. I see them having such a fantastic time, and I'm like, all right, was it delicious or what?
Okay, that's a good one. That's a really good one. Any over here? Yeah.
I think a part of my conflict is that, you know, culturally, I want to be able to mourn some people that have, some loved ones that I've lost, which I guess is kind of along the lines of attachment.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, to me, culturally, it's important to mourn the loss of loved ones.
Mm-hmm.
And then coming here, it's, you know, you shouldn't. Life goes on, and it's okay that they're gone. And it's an internal conflict that...
So you're saying Buddhism is saying that you shouldn't mourn the loss of others, and you should just move on.
Right.
Which is what you want to do, but
right,
eventually,
right.
Anyway, you do the process of mourning.
Right.
Yeah. Next to you, you have to make up something.
I guess for me, it's just focusing. That's the hard thing for me to just even getting through the breathing was hard. My brain is very jumpy. So,
right.
Yeah.
So just doing the practice. Yeah. As a beginner, too. Right. Doing the practice. Anything?
For me, I think the hardest. Well, reincarnation has kind of already been said, but to summarize kind of what someone else said and just say it in a different way is I think spiritual practice becomes the next arena for self-judgment. And kind of some of the teachings, when you already have a negative mind, sometimes you find myself using some of the precepts or teachings to kind of beat myself up. And so I have to, like, work not to do that and let go of that as well. And there's...
Right.
Limitless things to let go of. So
yeah. That sort of self-judgment kind of sounds a little bit like putting yourself down for not, a little bit like guilt. I'm guilty. I did that. I do that. I've done it. I will do it again. Things like that, yeah. All right, so time's up, so we're, no, I'm just kidding. So, is that good? You want to add one on there?
I guess just knowing that you have to start somewhere, kind of thing. Just knowing that you have to start somewhere is kind of, I guess, where all that kind of like, I don't know.
You got to start somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I guess isn't negative.
Well, yeah. There's a book out by somebody. What's her name? Pema Chodron. Start Where You Are. I like that name. I like the title. Okay. We're going to take it individually and collectively, take a shot at these things and see if we can... what time do we have to finish up? 10 after? Quarter after? Quarter after. Okay. Not part of our culture. So I think we've talked about that. I will say this. Like when my first exposure to Buddhism, I was in Nepal in a Buddhist monastery, and a lot of this that's here and even more was in the room. And I'm a Calvinism person, you know. I'd come from a Presbyterian background, but I wasn't really practicing Christianity. I had tried and tried, but I couldn't quite make it work for me. Anyway, so I came into this thing, and I was totally put off by all the iconography, and that's one of the reasons I wore my orange shirt today, just because, you know, if this was a Zen temple, guess what color everything would be? Black. The statue would be gold, but everything else would be pretty much black. And, you know, and in Theravada Buddhism, it's sometimes oranges, but it's kind of like saffron. But in Tibetan Buddhism, it's like colors like you wouldn't believe. What is all of this? What are all these statues and graven images and so on? Well, that was a bit of a struggle until I learned what it meant. And when you understand that, for example, the Buddhist, when we do prostrations, we're not only paying homage to the teachings, but to our own potential to become enlightened, right? So it's like every practice, everything in this Gompa, every flag, every picture is meant to help us transform our mind. It's meant to be an object for practice. And we could become bewildered by that, thinking that we have to, again, swallow it all at one time, believe it all. And so it's taken me, you know, a lot of years, and I still don't understand everything that I see. But the more I understand what these things mean. And the more I use them in my practice, the more I see that they're helpful. Some are, some aren't. But, you know, for example, the Buddha, the statue of the Buddha symbolizes enlightened body, and the text, enlightened speech, and the stupa over here, enlightened mind. So every altar is going to have at least that much. Symbols of enlightened body, speech, and mind. So, but there's many, many, you know, much more that could be said about that. All right, karmic retribution. What goes around comes around. It stinks. I mean, it really does. But it's our big job in life is to watch our mind, isn't it? That's our big job, and it's hard work. Now, do you have to watch your mind all the time? No, you don't. You don't have to. But once we have some faith, I mean, and you don't even have to believe and have a belief in karma to realize that if you let your mind just roll on, untethered, and follow its instincts, I mean, that's called samsara. That's the cycle of uncontrolled causation, and it generally leads to more suffering. Most of us, even that call ourselves Buddhist, we take our past, throw it in front of us, and walk right back into it. We do the same thing over and over and over again, expecting a different result. It doesn't work. Karma is a very profound part of Buddhism, and it, you know, for me in this very moment, what it means to me is that whatever's happening to me right now, it's not helpful for me to think, well, in 45 lifetimes ago, I killed an insect, or I lied, or I stole. That's not helpful. What's helpful for me is that every moment, in fact, in this very moment, billions of karmic seeds are ripening from my past that are forcing me to see this room and have an experience that I call my life. And how I deal in this moment is creating the future. So, you know, this is the powerful message in karma, is that we can shape our future by the choices we make. And whatever is happening is a resultant. So if we find ourselves in a great situation, fantastic. That means we did something wonderful in the past. Yay, we should rejoice. If we find ourselves in a big mess, that's also a resultant. Okay? And we can learn from that. We can say, wow, I don't want to do that again. Look, it's what's happening to me. I got to watch my mind. I need to pay attention. I need to practice the path. I need to avoid killing and stealing and so forth. Now, here's a really interesting point. In any given moment, like right now, right this second, how do you know when what you're doing is going to lead to happiness or suffering? Anybody know the answer to that? How do you know? Because whatever you do now is going to ripen probably in 50,000 lifetimes from now. Let's just say, for example. So, but let's say next life. Yeah. Exactly. So the point is this, is you're right on the money. The point is this, our motivation is the key factor in karma, not what we do necessarily. What we do is important because it's very difficult to kill out of compassion, isn't it? Very difficult to kill or steal and say, I'm doing that for their good or whatever, or I'm doing it for the goodness, of, for the benefit of all. But our motivation in the moment is the key factor in karma. And so if we check and see if our action is motivated by non-attachment, non-hatred, or non-ignorance, it will always lead to happiness. We will be forced at some point in the future to see ourselves as happy, because what goes around comes around. Karma will eventually ripen. It does not waste it. And if we're motivated by greed and hatred and ignorance and so forth, the delusions, we will be forced to see ourselves as suffering. But it's a resultant. And it can be a hard thing to accept, because it's really meant for us to work with it ourselves. But, you know, when you see a newborn baby in the intensive care unit with tubes coming out of every orifice and the kid's dying, and you go, well, what did that kid do to deserve that? And you can't, that's not helping your mind. But from the worldview of karma, everything is a resultant. It's not personal. The fact that we're suffering, karma's like gravity. Bam. You kill, you'll get killed. You steal, people will steal from you. If you commit adultery, you know, you'll have lousy relationships and people will cheat on you. If you lie, people will lie to you. And it's not personal. It feels like there's no God. You know, the God in Buddhism is the laws of nature. This is the creative force. It's impersonal. It's not about you or your personality. It's just, and that's a very hard thing for some people to. Yeah. And we see other people misbehaving and doing stupid things, and we think, you know, they are the product of all of their former conditioning. They're literally being used by their karma. You know, and give them some space to be stupid and make mistakes and not be so critical and judgmental and forgive. It could help that. Yes. Well, here's the deal. Until you get enlightened, you're always going to be motivated by self-interest. But there is such a thing as enlightened self-interest, which is doing things for others. Because you understand karma. You understand that if you do something selflessly, to the degree that you're able to do that, obviously if you give a gift to somebody and you think, okay, now where's mine? That's not the same thing as giving it and saying, I don't want anything in return. So to the degree that we're able to give selflessly, this, you know, that's the point in generosity. But, you know, feeling bad about, what did you say again? Feeling guilty about feeling good. Oh my God, that's too convoluted. I can't go there. That's a hard one. Let's move along, because we're never going to get through any more of these things. I have to. This one up here leads. What is the one about deliciousness?
Enjoyment.
Oh, enjoyment. Because that's an important thing. I think, you know, attachment and so forth. We might need to do this. Enjoyment. Yikes. All right. Addicted. So it looks like Buddhism is saying that we can't have fun. And I'm out of here if we can't have fun. Addicted to Ajahn Buddhadasa. He's a great Thai Buddhist saint. He said, these are his words, addicted to deliciousness. I love that concept. That's how we are, isn't it? I mean, be honest. We want everything that's good, and we don't want anything that's bad. Is that right? Yeah. For you, deliciousness is discipline. So any deliciousness is anything that's desirable. Anything, you know, and it's kind of like But we're talking about an obsession here. That's what's causing the problem. Obsessing about delicious things. I will have to tell you a story here real quick. How do you spell obsessing? Is that close enough? Anyway, obsessing. So I have a 6-year-old daughter, and when she was in preschool, she had a boyfriend named been. And they used to lie on cots together when they were four and hold hands and stuff like this. And now she's in the first grade, and I saw that Ben was in her classroom, and I said, Annabelle, I see that Ben's in your classroom, you know, kind of trying to get her going a little bit. She said, this is a six-year-old. She said, oh, I don't obsess about him anymore. That's what we're talking about, obsessing. I think there are two S's here. Anyway, obsessing about things that are deliciousness. So here's the problem with obsession, isn't it? And it's instinctive, because as long as we have an I, we project the false sense of I. Now, Buddhism is not saying that, for those of you who are new, Buddhism is saying we don't exist. Buddhism is saying we don't exist the way we think we exist. There is an I. Don't get me wrong. There's a body and a mind, and based on the collection of those two, we're just an I. We're just the self. But what do? Ignorance inflates it like a big inflatable slide, you know? Inflates the sense of I to such it's bigger than the world. And then anything that's pleasurable, delicious, what do we want? We want it. We got to have it. And the more we addicted to it, guess what? When we don't have it, how do we feel? Terrible. And when we lose it, we're miserable. So it's like we can't win. And even when we get what we want, we can't thoroughly enjoy it because we're clinging on to it so tightly. We're like, so it's not that sex and drugs and rock and roll and having fun and going to Disney World and going to a party and listening to good music and having a good meal and being with friends. The Buddha never said there was anything wrong with that. Lama Yeshe used to say, hey, Buddhism, people think it's about, you know, suffering and giving up everything. And he said, no, you got it all wrong. It's about having a great time. It's about having the best time. But how can you have a good time when all you're doing is creating the causes for more suffering? We have to think about what we're doing, you know, so we can, you know, there's a teaching called the Eight Worldly Dharmas, and they kind of distill everything that's positive into pleasure, gain, fame, and praise. Okay, those are sort of the things that, generally speaking, we're attracted to, or we find delicious. So we want those things, right? So when we get pleasure, yes. But again, because we're clinging, we can't really enjoy it fully. When we don't have pleasure, I want pleasure. You know, so we're looking for it. And when we get pain, oh my God, it's even worse. If we, you know, if you go see people that, like the Tibetans or Eskimos or people that have a really tough life, you know, they have a huge, their pain threshold is unbelievable. You know, I mean, I remember lancing an abscess in a Tibetan guy one time, and he said, ah, don't worry about the xylocaine. And so I just took a knife and whoosh, lanced this abscess on his face, and he didn't even flinch. Because this guy lives at, you know, 15,000 feet above sea level, and, you know, he's a rough life. He he's not addicted to pleasure like I am. So, again, it's not that having pleasure or any of it is a problem. Having sex, having fun, going places, doing whatever you want to do, it's your business. But the more we cling, the more we have some sort of addiction or obsession about it, the more we're going to suffer. That's all. So if we can live in the moment and experience the experience without clinging, then we're not creating suffering or as much suffering. We also have to be honest about what we can do. Like, you know, I've seen this happen over the years because I've been involved in Buddhism for so many years. I've seen a lot of Western people like, oh, this makes so much sense. I love Buddhism and I'm practicing it. It helps me. So I'm just going to give up everything. I'm gonna give up my belongings. I'm gonna become a monk or a nun or whatever. I've seen hundreds of people do that, and I've seen hundreds of people burn out doing that. You know, like becoming monastics, but which is another problem area for people, right? Being monastic, you know, that you have to be a monk or a nun to really Would Venerable George, is Buddhism all or none? And Venerable George said, no, it's monk or none. Anyway, so you get, does that kind of touch on that? Do you get a sense of what I'm talking about? It's not that pleasures or any of that's bad or wrong. It's just, we can see it. The more we obsess, the more we suffer. So what's the antidote to attachment, this kind of afflictive attachment or obsessing? What's the antidote to it? If it's squeezing, it's letting go. It's letting go of the attachment. How do you do that? Wow, that takes a lifetime of practice. But we can do it. That's the claim of Buddhism. That's liberation. Every moment that you have a thought in your mind and you're obsessing about somebody or something, or you're angry about something, you know, in that moment you're clinging to that thought and you say, oh my gosh, look at me, I'm clinging. And you watch it and it changes and then it disappears and you let go. That's a moment of liberation, isn't it? That's a moment of freedom. Things are impermanent. So if we can just be patient with the processes of our mind, things clear out. But as long as we obsess, we're stuck. Help me here. What's another? I should have gone like this. Okay, now everybody clap. Which one is the next one to that we should talk about? Overwhelming. Who had a burnt? Which one was burnt? It's like a mourning losses, by the way. Absolutely, you know. I was in Dharamsala, India, working. This is in northern India, working at a Tibetan refugee hospital when one of the Dalai Lama's brothers died. And I was living in a guest house that was run by another one of the Dalai Lama's brothers. And his wife used to come down when I was eating dinner, and I used to talk to her sometimes. And because they were going up to His Holiness's, you know, where he lived, the Dalai Lama. And I said, is he sad? Is he crying? You know, blah, blah, blah. And she said, you know, he's been affected by it, but he's not maudlin. You know, he's not like weeping. So my suspicion is if you live your life with an unrealistic expectation that things are going to last forever, then you're really shocked when you lose things. But if you have trained your mind over a lifetime that things are constantly in a state of flux and deterioration, and that nothing is going to last, everything is like change, 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 that the process of grieving goes quicker. It's much easier to let go of the pain of it. And so she felt like he had worked through the grief very quickly. That was what she was telling me. Because he wasn't standing right, you know. But anyway, so I think grieving, we all have to do it at our own pace. But there's nothing wrong about grieving. It's just, but what is grief? It's holding on to a sadness, isn't it? It's the mind clinging to something that's sad. We want, to the degree that we want to be happy, to that degree we don't want to be sad. Right? So when we're clinging to happiness, we're also clinging to not being sad. You see what I'm saying? It's just the flip side of the coin. So when we're sad, we're going to hold on to that. And letting go of that is important at some point. It's a choice, but there's nothing wrong with being sad. There's nothing wrong with having grief. You know, it just doesn't have to last 6 years or 3 months. It could last 3 minutes if you've trained your whole life to let go and move, you know, and be in the present moment. Yeah. Killing insects. Oh my gosh. I've got to call Bob the Critter Getter. No, it's a really tough one. Killing anything is a tough issue. Donna, am I done? Pardon? Yeah, so we need to wrap it up. Killing is doing any kind of non-virtuous, what's considered to be a non-virtuous action. And insects seem to be pretty low on the food chain or the life chain, you know, in terms of and microbes and so on and so forth. It's a tough one. And so if you have cockroaches in your house or you know, if you've got a tick, I mean, look at all the tick-borne illnesses now. It's pretty bad. So these insects, some of them are carrying diseases and they're in our house and rodents and so forth. I think what I can say about that is if there's a way to get rid of them without killing them, do it. And that's all I'm going to say. But we have, in my house, we have, and I gave Geshula one of these. It's called a Bugzooka. Have you ever seen it? No, it's a bug. It's a little thing that has a spring on it. It looks like an accordion, but it's round. And you push it down, and it's a long tube with a little gadget on the end of it. And so when we find insects, we go down with the Bugzooka and go, and it sucks them up into this little chamber, and then we take them outside. Now, if I had 1,000 ants, I'm sorry, Bob the credit getter is coming, and we're getting rid of those guys. But that's me. I'm not telling you to do that. But if there's another way to get rid of ants without killing them, I think I had a friend who had rodents, like a lot of mice in her house. And she would catch one at a time and carry them a couple miles down the beach or something and liberate them. And one time I was in a retreat house and it had mice. And every morning I'd catch one or two. And this guy named Chuck Thomas would bring me food, and then I would put the mice in the cage, and Chuck would take them 2 miles down the road and get rid of them. Because you don't want to. So you look for alternatives. If you can, that's great. If you can't, then you have to do the right thing. You have to do what's best for your health and your family's health. That's how I would say it. This is not. I'm not speaking for the Geshe Gelug or the Kadampa Center. Sarah's going to get me, I'm sure. I'm in trouble. Yeah, like what is the karmic cause of having a bunch of living in a nasty place with a bunch of critters? Be useful to think about that too. So this is a good conversation. I'm glad we talked about it. Any parting shots. By the way, I'll stick around and I'm not going anywhere. I got to do this. I get to do this again. But if you have if your question didn't get answered or if you want to talk about something else, I'll sit around. But let's do the dedication verses, please. I think there's a pink sheet at the top of the pink sheet. We'll do the master, you know, verses from Shantideva's Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. Okay. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with the mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness, and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains and as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. You know, collectively and individually, you know, but collectively it's very powerful to practice in a group much more than practicing alone. So the fact that you got up early this morning and everybody looks pretty clean for the most part, you know, cleaned yourself up and came here to do, you know, to practice together. We created some positive energy. And so we want to, so we're dedicating it not only to our happiness, because we're part of all sentient beings, aren't we? But to all sentient beings' happiness. So that's the kind of attitude we want to have. So these are merits. What we've done is create merit, guaranteed will ripen into happiness. Guaranteed positive merit ripens into happiness. So we can rejoice that we did this. And thank you. Thank you for coming.